Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very bluntly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are much important, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topic of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. And there's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is not if your remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. Lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for providing us with that detailed disclaimer. It's so incredibly important. The work that we've been promoting for nearly 30 years now for information providers who offer unique services, we've skirted or not even been broached with practicing law without a license, I believe, due to your excellent disclaimer. So with that having been said, I want to share something before I bring PJ on that I think will be of interest to you. I want to go back to an email that I received earlier today. This is from, it's called USCCA. USCCA is the United States Concealed Carry Association. And the email said, quote, "This fall the Supreme Court will take up a case to decide whether you have the right to carry a concealed weapon outside of your own property." Then as we count down on this critical ruling, we want to hear from you to know what you think. If you believe that the concealed carry rights should extend far beyond our own homes, add your name here. Goes on and on and on. So I reached out to them. I picked up the phone, got somebody on the phone, and we had a chat. And supposedly, with the things that we talked about, I will be hearing back from one of their lawyers. We'll see how that works out. Point being is this. If you are a federal citizen, if you are a territorial citizen, you don't have rights. You don't have the Bill of Rights. You don't have all the other rights enumerated in a Constitution for the United States of America, a Declaration of Independence, the Northwest Ordinance, the Articles of Confederation. You have none of that. Because as a federal citizen, you have to ask permission for everything that you do. And they charge you a fee, a tax, a processing fee, whatever it is. And they may or may not grant you what you want to do. But if they do grant it to you, then they hand you a set of rules that are demonstrably difficult and very controlling. And as it is, because you're a territorial citizen, you're a federal citizen. On the other hand, if you're a citizen of one of the several states, and we've talked about this, we've covered all the court cases over the years that we've been talking about this, there is no permission. There are no stipulations. In fact, the federal government is absolutely barred from even having a conversation with you with regards to these issues. They have no say-so that, you know, you have a 38 concealed in your waistband. And when you go to traffic court or whatever else, you know, can you show me in the Constitution where it says you can't take a weapon into a courtroom? It's not very prudent to, but the answer is that your rights are not up for discussion. And the rights enumerated and the rights not enumerated are absolutely barred from discussion from the federal government. And the other thing to understand is that the state government that you think is the state government, being one of the several states of the union, that's not true. In fact, here in Florida, we have Florida, a de jure republic, one of the several states of the union. And then we have the state of Florida, which is a territory of the United States. So, without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to PJ. Go ahead, Guy.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Yeah, it's very interesting how the Gun Owners Association, the Rifles Association, the one you just mentioned, how they, I've never heard one of their lawyers ever address a group of people and explain the distinctions between the laws made for the United States and how far they reach territorially. I just can't believe that they don't have one person that would stick their head out and say, hey, let's look at the extent of their land jurisdiction. It's just very disappointing. They have trained us from kindergarten up and throughout the college, the Bar Association and higher education, all these people have been basically corralled to speak the same line, and that is that the federal government's laws are the supreme law of the land, and the states have to yield to them. And that is true to the extent of their land jurisdiction, which is, I think it's now 25% of the landmass of what we call America. And a big chunk of that is Alaska and Nevada. But in Nevada is 84% government land, so don't go on there and think that you can run around with a gun extremely freely. You probably can as a right, but you're probably going to get thrown in jail for doing it, and you better know what you're doing to get out of there. But, yes, it's people do not realize that the federal government is actually one of the lowest levels to have interaction with the people. The federal government is designed to be a military force. It appears to me like they are designed to receive new people into the what they call America landmass. And when a person comes into America, they do have legitimate grounds to actually kind of operate with that individual probationarily. And I would say that, and biblically saying that, because when you study the scriptures and the history of countries, before you got any rights in that country, you had to live there and provide for your own needs for 7 years or even more before you even had any rights to vote or anything like that. So I believe there is a legitimate thing about people coming into a country and being under a probationary time, but I don't think it extends throughout their entire life biblically. But anyway, if you're born on American soil and you live on American soil and you work on American soil and you have no federal contract and no contracts with the state that are federally tied, no contracts with the federal government at all, You are completely independent of them, and Michael Edwards is completely right. They have no business even talking to you about anything, just as long as you stay off their land. Now, when you do go on their land, it's different. You're all the land owned by the United States, which is 24% of that land of America. 25% is considered a military base. So naturally, you don't carry a gun on a military base without giving notice, because you can pretty easily get shot if you start pointing the gun in the wrong direction on a military base with a gun in your hand. They're going to surround you, and they're going to tell you to drop it. And if you don't drop it really, really quick, you're probably going to get shot. That what I'd like to address is people should stand up and get educated, and I blame the churches for this. The church should be actually teaching people their rights, and they should be teaching the parents how to teach the children of their rights and the right to independence of the United States. What fascinates me is that an individual can bring home $50,000 or $100,000, and he is scared to death to even ask anybody if he has a federal duty to file or pay. They don't even want to talk about it. They're scared. They are so scared. They go, well, I make enough money to be happy. And all those people that actually challenge the government, they end up in jail. And the truth is, only a small percentage of people end up in jail, and it's because they don't have the knowledge to defend themselves generally. If you're a United States citizen, it's very likely you're not going to win an IRS case. But if you're an American-born, we've never lost a case with an American-born individual. We're on one case now that's American-born. The guy paid his taxes, and he filed our documents to question if he had a legal duty to file or pay. But he didn't do it right. He was supposed to not pay, and he was supposed to just file our documents and make them come forward with the assessments and so forth to verify that he had a legal duty to pay and an amount due. But anyway, that'll be the first case that we would have lost if it continues that way. It's on appeal right now. But of course, he didn't follow the instructions very well. Vast amount of Americans, I would say 99% of them are so scared to do anything. When they say go down and get vaccinated, they're going to run down and get vaccinated. When they say turn your neighbor in if he's not vaccinated, they're going to turn the neighbor in for not being vaccinated. That was told to them to do. An individual that I work with, he was working with a school teacher that had a, I can't remember if she was going into retirement or something like that, but she was cleaning her desk out and she was putting stuff in her purse and boxes, and one of the other people that worked at school noticed that she had a gun in her purse, and they surrounded her with a bunch of police forces and tackled her, and I think they even broke her arm, just a bunch of nut. And he was able to go into court and challenge them to produce any evidence in the Constitution. That's the only place they get their authority. They don't get their authority from anything else other than the Constitution. Now, why would that be? Because they are confined to the limitations that have been laid out by the American people. And it's in written format. We call it the Constitution. That constitutes them as their limits. But we simply go into court. One of the number one thing you need to remember when you go into a court is you don't necessarily – I'm just kind of learning this stuff. I've always kind of went in with statements. But when I meet high-level lawyers, they go in there and they say, you need to ask questions. The less statements you make, the better off you are, and the more comfortable you can be with these people. You can just simply ask the judge. This is what he did. Your Honor, where in the Constitution is my client forbidden to have that gun in her purse on the school grounds or right now in this courtroom. And the judge basically turned the opposing party to produce the evidence, and the case was dismissed, and rather amazing. Now, if he would have went in and making a statement about, you know, she has a right to do this and a right to do that, it would have been a lot more difficult. But he phrased it in such a way to completely keep the burden of proof on them. She didn't say she had rights. She didn't say she didn't have rights. She didn't talk about the territorial jurisdiction issue or anything like that. She just simply said, where in the Constitution is my client forbidden to have that particular gun in her purse on the school grounds or in your courthouse courtroom today? And they didn't have an answer. The judge had to dismiss the case. It's quite novel how he did that. We're going through a large case. It's a $538 million case where a guy was thrown into jail for 10 years falsely. He was making $2 million a year. Ruined his career, his marriage, his family, his income. And we're putting the appeal documents in, and they're trying to throw the 1983 civil suit out because failure to state a claim, which relief can be granted. But the premise of the case is there was never a legal duty for this individual to withhold any taxes for his employees. There's no evidence in the court record of his criminal prosecution where they actually got that on the record. No place. It was just assumed. It was assumed from the beginning. It was assumed in the end. It was assumed during the 9.5 years he was in jail. It's assumed now that we're coming into the civil suit and trying to go for damages. And the simple strategy that we have in the appeals court predominantly is, where in the Constitution is it written that my client has a requirement to withhold taxes from the ministry workers back in 2006? Completely keeping the burden of proof on them. Now, we've asked the same question to the IRS for the last 20 years on that same scenario, because he was asking 10 years before he went to jail. They refused to give him an answer. We've been asking ever since. So that's probably more than 20 years now. And the judges are trying to say that, the opposing party is trying to say that we're not stating a claim for which relief can be granted. Now, how in the world can we put forth such a simple question and be denied a response? Who are we? Are we a servant, or are we the employer here? Are we the employee, or are we the employer? Michael, what do you think about that in this situation? Are we the people, the employer, or the employee of the federal government?
Actually, in my opinion, it's more base than what you're asking. Who is the sovereign, and who is the servant to the sovereign? We've all grown up with the expression that somebody in public office is a what? Public servant. Well, who are they servant to? The sovereigns. And there are multiple court decisions that talk about the sovereignty of the various citizens of the several states within the union.
Exactly. We're working on this one case here, and the judges are trying to make sure that we don't have our day in court. Because we're actually trying to position ourselves to get in front of 12 jurors and put the IRS agent on the witness stand and simply say, you've had 60 days, 90 days to bring in this evidence. You were told 90 days ago to get this evidence. And we gave you the exact scenario that occurred in 2006, the exact land, the exact number of church ministry workers, the exact activity, the exact description of the person that you claim was liable to withhold, and we're asking them to testify if that individual has a legal duty to withhold. And they will not answer the question. They claim they don't have to answer the question. Now, guess what? If you step into that activity and don't withhold, they come down on you, and a SWAT team comes and surrounds your ministry and arrests you, and it goes on national TV and local TV and radio, and your life is ruined pretty much until it's cleared. And it's never cleared because those feathers of false rumors are going to float around forever. You can't go collect them all. But now, how in the world can the servant turn and look at the sovereign, the employer, and say, we don't have to answer you. We're just going to arrest you and throw you in jail, but we're not going to answer the fundamental question that you had a legal duty, if you had a legal duty to withhold. It's just amazing that these judges think they can get away with that. And that's true with pretty much every interaction with these United States courts. Michael, think of some examples. I'll start out with a few, and if you got a couple, throw them in there. But you're traveling down the road. You get a ticket. You end up in front of the judge. Your Honor, where in the Constitution is it written that I'm forbidden that particular form of mobility on that particular land? They have to answer that.
Hendricks versus Maryland. A U.S. citizen, upon leaving the District of Columbia, becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law right to travel of a citizen of one of the several states. End quote.
Now, you got to remember, what is interstate commerce? Interstate commerce is not reaching into the private sector land. Interstate commerce is one federal zone to another federal zone. So it sounds like they're barring that individual from driving in America. But no, if you look up the definition of interstate commerce, clearly identifies it's one federal zone to another federal zone. They are not making law as associated with travel in any other land than federal zones there. They sure make it sound like it, but they aren't, which is true for all their written laws. It's limited to their land. If you get a parking ticket, where in the Constitution am I forbidden to park my automobile there without harassment by the city, county, or state? Now, if the city, county, or state owns that land where you had your car parked, yeah, that's a different story. But if it's owned by the store owner, or did the store owner come out and write me a ticket? No, the state came in there, the city, the county. Well, the city and county can't come in unless they own the land. And they don't want to admit that they own very few roads. And if they do, in my experience, when they make it look like they own a road, if you study the deed of conveyance very close, it's written in such a way to, like one of them was state of Nebraska. They made it sound like, oh, this is government land. It's just state of Nebraska. No, if you study the Constitution, it says the only style of as owner of record can be the United States of America. They're not allowed to have state of Nebraska as an identifier of government land. Now, state of Nebraska can be converted or established as an entity of under the laws of the United States, but it's only under the laws of the United States. It's not the United States, so it would just be an entity, and still not of the same land jurisdiction as the United States of America, which they don't want you to go down that road because that's a really dead end for them financially. Oh, some other area, federal taxes. Your Honor, where in the Constitution does my daily activity of providing food for my family and housing for my family, recreational spending for my family, where in the Constitution am I required to give part of those proceeds to the United States? Same way with state taxes. You'd say the same thing. Property taxes. Your Honor, where in the Constitution is private land taxed? And you'll see things get really nervous in a courtroom when they do that. I've done it before. And they just like, oh, my gosh, they take a break. They run out of the courtroom. We're going to continue this meeting down the road. They just don't know how to deal with that because that is so explosively, what do you call it, transparent, if they'd ever answer that. They don't dare want that. That judge is one lawyer walked up to me later on. He says, boy, that judge was almost at the verge of telling all of the people of the state that their land is not taxable. And that would, he said, that would be an absolute blacklisting of him. His career would be destroyed. His social life would be destroyed. He would be potentially killed if he continued doing that. But it was interesting how a lawyer walked up and talked to me about it after the deal. But, Michael, you got any comments?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to open up the call to Q&A. Press star 2 on your keypad, star 2, and that'll raise your hand on a board that I'm looking at, and I'll unmute your phone. For those of you listening on Freedoms Radio, you will notice a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side in the middle of your monitor. Left-click inside of it and begin typing away your comment or your question, and I'll be glad to give voice to what it is you've said. And for PJ's comment, I do want to establish clearly that our federal constitution clearly indicates that there are taxes we are liable for. If we're talking about a federal tax, it's called apportionment, meaning that if the federal tax that year is $1,800, it's $1,800 to John D. Rockefeller, and it's $1,800 to Harold and Green Bay. It doesn't matter. The point being is that it's apportioned equally amongst everyone. There's also all of the excise taxes, all of the impost taxes, and all of the, what do you call them? Tariffs.
Tariffs.
Those are all taxes we are liable to pay. When you go to the fuel station and you purchase a tank of fuel for your car, that is a lawful tax. It's called an excise tax. It's been added to the price per gallon of that fuel. So understand that that's the realm of citizens of the several states that they have in their tax liabilities. Our first question comes from Harold in Green Bay. That's why I got a little cheeky and mentioned that. Go ahead, Harold.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I got a question on what PJ was just talking about. The land that's owned by the state or the federal government what about land that they so-called, quote-unquote, is owned by the town, like a village or a township? You know, the town
is a corporation. State of Nebraska is a corporation. Municipalities are corporations. The city of, it's a corporation. But that's distinct. They're under the laws of the United States, but they're not the United States. They're only under the laws of the United States.
My question is, can they zone your building? Here's my point. When I first bought the land and built the building, they had a meeting and they called it an R3, which is residential three, like for a duplex or for a six family home or whatever. And later on, they converted it to a commercial land. The zoning part of it, is that, are they legal to do that?
They can make you wear a red shirt when you're on that land if they own that land. So that's the distinction you have to get them to. You have to keep the burden of proof on them, ideally, to produce evidence that they have an ownership interest in the land. Now they may that 100 years ago the land may have been sold. I don't know how old our country is with land patents, but you know, let's just say 150 years ago, 200 years ago, what, almost. The land may have been sold where they retained an ownership interest. But not most of the time the land was sold in its entirety. They did not retain a minerals rights or a use rights or passage rights or water rights. Oil rights, whatever. Sometimes you can find the land patent or the land grant, and it'll clearly communicate that it was conveyed in ultimate title, which means nothing was reserved back to the seller. If that's the case, they have to produce evidence that they repurchased the land to gain a proprietary interest in that land. Now, that's the only way they can have zoning authority, is with proprietary interest in the land. Now, let's just say that you did own a piece of land in the middle of, just one small lot, a sixteenth of an acre, and you built a really super tall structure on it. Now, in common law, the community can get together and say that, hey, this thing is dangerous. You know, it's going to fall over and hurt somebody. Now, if it was a big enough piece of land where it would only fall on itself, on its own land, then they wouldn't have a nexus. But if it could fall over on somebody else's land, the community has a right to say, hey, this is not right. This is dangerous.
Well,
so that's what you'll have to do.
The reason why I'm asking is because the building we built on it, on one side we live on one side, and the other side was a chiropractic office. So we lived and worked both in the same one. Well, now they're making me, you know, we're trying to sell the building, and people are going over to the town to find out what has to be done, and they're giving them all kinds of different excuses about different things, and We had a hard time trying to sell the land. That's the issue.
Well, you can write letters to them, and where in the Constitution do you have the right to apply state zoning laws here, or city or county or some municipality zoning laws here? They have to produce that information.
Okay.
If they're going to make a claim of governance, they have to produce the evidence. I mean, you can't walk down the road and just start governing all the children in the park. You know, you got to prove that those children are your children, right? Or they're under your care. You can't walk up and spank a child, and you're going to be in big, big trouble. But if you get proof, that's your child, it changes everything.
Yeah,
so.
PJ, if I could help here for just a second, you had shared with us a couple of times, but it's been a long time ago now, but you shared with us a couple of times in the United States Code where it identifies the words like city and county and state as being territories of the United States. You shared that before. Why don't you share how that...
When a lawyer, a lion lawyer, sometimes they don't even know it. When a lion lawyer or a deceased lawyer fills out a warranty deed or a quick claim deed because you went in there and asked him to do it, or the seller did, and they put identifiers on there. They put, in the county of Webster County, and they put in the city of Dallas or whatever, and then they put in the state of Texas, and then they put in the United States, possibly. All three of those identifiers are referring to, and he doesn't even know it, a federal zone. If you go into a the definitions in the federal statutes at large, it defines county as a federal zone. So anytime somebody puts the word county in a United States record, the county is defined as the United States Congress has defined it. And they defined it as a federal zone. So I've been in tax court before, and the judge starts hollering at me, trying to get me to say that it's in the county. And years ago, I was stupid enough to say, yeah, territorially. And then he said, okay, I rule for the county. I rule against PJ. That inspired me. I went home and looked up the definition of county, and lo and behold, I found out I was just telling the court record that it was a federal zone. Now, me telling the court record that it was a federal zone doesn't make it a federal zone. I can go back into those cases, even if they're 200 years old, and correct the presumption that the record might convey to that administrator and affect the determination in that case. So, anyway, does that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. I think that clears up some of the muddiness.
But let me finish. Michael got me thinking there. When you go to the statute, it says it'll say state. Some states will say give the definition for state. It'll another state will give the definition as this state, and another state will give a definition. They call it a term, actually. In this state. So it's three different things. State, this state, in this state. And then you copy all the terms defined in the statutes. And you do a search on those three things. State, this state, in this state. And you'll find, every time I've ever done it, you'll find that one of them is defined in the statutes. You know, like you'll look up the word state defined, or in this state defined, or this state defined, and your computer will grab it, and you know, a lot of times there's just hundreds of words there. You can't find it without the search engine. So I copy all the statutes. It takes a long time for it to download those things, even on the computer. And I run a search on it, and they hide those things. You can't find them. But you'll find a definition of the word state, for example, and it'll say, all three of those will say the same thing. It'll say a possession or territory of the United States.
Okay.
Now, somebody talks to you and says, is that land over there a possession or territory of the United States? If it's a military base, you'll probably say, yes, right? Now, if it's your house, you'll probably say, no, that's my private land. There's a huge difference. But when you go into court and you say that land that they're trying to put a zoning regulation on, and you tell them, you don't challenge their defining it as a county or city or state or in this state or state, that it'll go before the administrator as a federal zone. And if it's a federal zone, they can zone the heck out of it. They can tax it. They can governance. They can destroy you at the use of it. So, if the property's got some value to it, we can help you out on that. You'll have to talk to Mike on the program.
I remember as a teenager way back 65 years ago, the land was a part of a farm, you know, part of a dairy farm or whatever. And,
In law, land is a three-dimensional space. In law, land is a three-dimensional space. Now, you have property rights in that three-dimensional space. You might have the right to intellectual property. You might have the right to, physical property. You might have a right to reside there. I don't like to use the word reside, but even the word resident in a court is defined in statutes as that you're living on federal land. I bring these definitions to seasoned lawyers. I show them, and they look at it and they go, "Oh my gosh, these people are deceiving us all the way from the White House. They're deceiving us.
Yeah.
This is incredible." And it's called statism, because you are not smart enough to govern your own life. You have to give a third or a half or a quarter of all your earnings to the Uncle Sam so he can make sure that you're taken care of.
Okay. We have another hand raised. Thank you. Harold, are there any questions?
No, it's been very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Next is Kent. Kent from Charleston. Go ahead, Kent. Unmute your phone, Kent. Give Kent a second to unmute his phone.
Sorry about that. I want to ask.
It happens
you,
often.
Okay, I wanted to ask you, Michael, and PJ, or either one of you. I haven't listened to a lot of your calls, as I said a few weeks ago when I came on. You're talking about being a citizen of one of the several states, and you elaborated a little bit on that tonight. Did you follow a certain procedure to establish that, wherein one might say you filed some affidavits or papers to change one's status, standing capacity? How did you take that position?
First off, you have to understand who you are. And once you have that understanding of who you are in the law, you keep your mouth shut. And anything that you do say is asking your opposition how they arrive at this classification of citizenship and how they arrive at the classification of land upon which the law is operating. You never assert who you are. It's the lack of the state evidencing who you are that enables them to run roughshod over you. So by you stopping everything and saying, whoa, you have yet to establish the land upon which you believe this offense took place. Is it land of one of the several states in the perpetual union, or is it land of the United States, a territory or a possession? And you make them, you don't let them go past that point. You don't let them talk about anything else until they've established that. That's my take on it. PJ?
Yeah, it's a jurisdictional challenge. The Constitution of the United States is a limiting document, and they are not. Now, when the United States makes laws, they're limited to who they can apply those laws to and where. And all you have to do, let's just say you bought a house, and there you start coming over and knocking on your door and say, hey, you got to pay us $1,000 taxes a year, $20,000 taxes a year, And most people say, oh, that tax is too high, or I'm not going to pay it, or that's theft, or no, you don't do that. You work with us, and we got programs we can put together, but in a roundabout way, we position it in a court setting. I mean, you might not ever have to go to court, but we let them know that if it does go to court, this is what's going to occur. The moving party and the judge, I ask, where in the Constitution is that written law to be applied in that land, in the subject land? And you don't call the land city, county, or state or anything. You just have a picture of the land and have a plat map there, and you just color your land red, and you say the red land right there, colored in red. See, they're going to try to get you to say, well, is that in Douglas County? Is that in Webster County? Is that in the state of Nebraska? Come on. Tell us. Don't speak up. And you go, isn't that your guys' burden to prove?
Exactly.
See, most people go to court that study law a little bit. They're just so eager to open their big fat mouth and talk. And I was at that stage for years. And I learned, no. Keep my mouth shut. Only open my mouth with a question. And do it really politely. And make sure you direct the question toward the right person, the one trying to govern your life. See that administrator sitting up there behind that bench in that black robe? He's trying to administrate. He's trying to apply written law to you or to your land. And he has to prove, he has to have on evidence, on the record, that he has authority to administrate you and the activity of your land. And if he can't produce that, he's out there all by himself, no judicial protection, and he's liable for any damage that he does, and he knows it. And he won't want to go down that dark alley. And that's how you win your cases with these guys. So what is your particular issue? I mean, you might.
All right, let me clarify that without giving you a particular issue or dragging the question out, because I understand basically what you're saying. I was thinking of the point of view of clarifying this early on to eliminate having to do it case by case, so that the Secretary of State, if you will, the appropriate Secretary of State in the one in the du jour capacity, both state and federal or national, is informed of your status. And, you know, I've been looking at the 1790 law, the 1795 law, naturalization, citizenship, the 1802 law, and I think that, you know, and you may or may not agree, I haven't listened to enough polls to know that the with the Reconstruction, that we didn't have a lawfully sitting Congress. So I don't really want to look at the 1906 law or the 2002 law and really, you know, put any weight to them. But I would think that we could go in under the 1802 law and make certain claims and get this established once and for all as to who we are without putting this all in statement form and still by asking some questions.
It's much easier than that. Black's Law Dictionary 6th edition has the definition of United States, and the two that apply to our conversation is this land of the several states which are united by and under the Constitution? Yes or no? Second question, is this land the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends? Yes or no? The prosecutor must put on record authenticated evidence, not hearsay, not rumor, not innuendo, authenticated evidence as to whether this is land of the several states which are united by and under the Constitution, or it's land over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. It's one or the other, Your Honor, or prosecutor, and you must put that on the record as per Black's Law Dictionary 6th edition. Simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't want to, they're not going to respond to your general claim. You have to pick. Let's just say a guy walks up to you with a government badge on, and he says your mailbox has to be back 10 feet, or your mailbox is too big, or your mailbox has to be. You just challenge his authority to instruct you where to put your mailbox. He has to produce the evidence that he has authority to tell you to do that. Now, if your mailbox like I had a friend, he built a mailbox out of a V8 engine, and he had it out there on the highway, you know. People realize, like, my gosh, if I run into that mailbox, it's going to go through my windshield at 60 mile an hour. I don't mind a 2-pound mailbox going hitting my windshield. That's not so bad, but a 300-pound engine or 200-pound engine block, that's a different story. So they instructed him. The community got together and instructed him to say, you know, you got a really neat mailbox there, but you can't do that. It's somebody's going to get killed. So there is an element of common law that always comes into play. It always comes into play. You got to remember that. But if they're just coming and there's no danger to anybody, common sense says, this guy shouldn't be talking to you. You challenge them. Does he have a legal interest? Does his employer have a legal interest in your land? May it be putting the fence up? May it be putting a building up? May it be putting a septic tank? Does he have a legal interest in your land? If you want to put a septic tank in, sometimes the state has an interest because the state owns all the land around your place and your septic could bleed into their land. But if they don't own any land for 5 miles within you, how in the world are they going to get evidence on the record that they have a legal interest in that septic tank when the neighbors next to you are not even complaining?
Well, they claim they own the water under the land.
Well, get them to prove that. If they own the land, water under your land, there is a common law principle to that, but that's something the community would have to agree on in common law, not in statutory law. Now, if they own the land, the government owns the land, they own the water and the oil and the minerals and the space above it. Yeah, same as you would if you owned it.
Mm-hmm.
But, housing codes, zoning codes, I had a friend that talked to a municipal code enforcement officer, and he said he could destroy anybody with these codes. And I watched them do it. They just keep coming back and they tell you, oh, it ain't right. You got to change that. And they just make it so. I've heard that in California, I think they said that 1/4 of the cost of the house is just code fees. And they probably don't have any jurisdiction for any code implementation other than in common law. Which, if you follow common sense, there's not going to be a common law issue anyway. Go ahead.
Okay, I don't want to pursue it any farther now. I'll think about what you have to say. I thank you for your answer.
Okay.
Welcome back. Glad to have you here. Let me check Freedom's Radio real quick to see if there's any questions there. If not, we're going to thank PJ for his time and call it a night. No, there's nobody there. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. There are some return calls that I have to make that I've been trying to put together answers for the questions that I know that are going to be asked on those return calls and have not been successful, which is why you haven't heard from me today. So until next week, I want to thank everybody. Good night and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.